So in tribute to the late, great Eddie Jordan, I'm going to predict we're going to talk about a driver switch in this episode. It's going to come from Alpine. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Hit him with the same accuracy that Eddie would have done. Hey, everybody, I'm Dre Harrison. Welcome to episode 571 of Motorsport 101. Very glad you could join us on this episode. And well, just when you thought we were having a quiet first couple of weekends to the 2025 F1 season, and we're discussing a driver switch. Now, to be fair, Cam, in our defense, in our preseason predictions, we did say there'd be a mid-season driver swap. But I'm going to admit, I didn't think it was going to be after round two.
Yeah, we're currently batting at about 0.55 Liz Truss cabbages on driver career length.
Ooh.
Oh, my God. it ain't great, Bob.
My money's still on the cabbage, quite frankly.
The cabbage probably could have qualified the Red Bull at least in Q2.
Yeah, that's probably a fair shout. I mean, it is still a pretty quick car on occasion. But
also,
in tribute of this monumentous news story, we've also swapped presenters. RJ O'Connell's taken a surprise week off. He'll be back soon. And replacing him for the weekend is our substitute, Mr. Ryan Eric King. Hello, buddy. Good to see
you. Hello. Just like another driver people have been asking, where have I been for so long? And
wait, you're lucky, Zach Hadja. What are you doing here? Cam, have you ever noticed that King's feeling a bit Argentinian lately, or is it just me?
I don't know. I mean, if you ever want to bring him back down to earth, just bring up KTM.
Oh no.
Although you don't have to fear Ken Roczen anymore on Supercross because he just blew out his shoulder, I believe. If you don't watch Monster Energy Supercross here in the States, it has been a rough year for injuries.
Yeah, Jesus. Even I've been paying attention to this year, and I'm like, holy shit, can somebody stay healthy for more than a week, please? Holy hell.
Yeah, I mean, we found a way to take down God, i.e. Jet Lawrence, apparently susceptible to torn ACLs.
See, if I was going to choose a weakness, I wouldn't have weak weak cruciate ligament as an injury. Not ideal, personally. But yes, this is going to be an absolutely heaped episode of Motorsport 101, because not only have we got a pretty newsworthy Grand Prix to talk about, and hey, it's a sprint weekend, so that was only going to make things even more interesting. Yes, we will talk about the breaking news coming out of Formula 1 that Liam Lawson has been demoted and swapped back to Racing Bulls, with Yuki Tsunoda going the other way, making his Red Bull debut next weekend at the Japanese Grand Prix. I cannot believe I'm saying this in March. We still have 8 months of season to go.
I say, however, you know, sure you were that this wasn't going to last, I don't think two rounds was going to be the prediction from just anybody.
Well, if you took the under, then congratulations. You pretty much guaranteed the win here. Well done.
Eddie Jordan is snickering.
It's like being in a vacation ship and it's over before you got your bag from baggage claim.
Oh, my Lord.
That was not the sort of Caribbean cruise I had in mind, King. I'm not going to be honest with you. Next week, you're going to turn the whole boat back around and you're still in Birmingham. It's just not ideal. It's my idea of a nightmare. So we've got to talk about that. We've got to talk about the small matter of the Chinese Grand Prix. A McLaren 1-2 finished their 50th in Formula 1 as Oscar Piastri would lead pretty much lights to flag to win in China. And we'll talk about McLaren. We'll talk about how Ferrari went from a sprint win, their first ever sprint win, to a double disqualification.
Ferrari are the innovators of Formula 1, and they've invented an all-new stat, winning and being disqualified in the same weekend.
Ferrari find literally new and inventive ways of honcing up the joint. And not only that, being disqualified for two different reasons as well. It's not even it was a uniform problem. You found separate ways to get DQ'd under the technical regulations. That is truly remarkable.
Yeah. And what, Ferrari's been around as a racing team for over 90 years at this point, and it's the first time that they've ever even been double disqualified.
And it's the first time in the 75-year history of Formula One that a team had both cars DQ'd for two different reasons. We've literally made history. This is
that is the kind of history you want to make.
That is a hell of a bingo card. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about where Red Bull sits after all of this. And we'll talk about, are we literally... I mean, this is a theme of switcheroos. We're going to switch up with the Bring Back V10s podcast. Hi, Glenn. Good to see you, buddy. We're going to talk about whether V10s might be viable in Formula One again. Spoiler alert. Probably not, but we'll talk about it anyway. But let's get into this. And before we really get started, let's do a quick social media wrap up. Basically, you can find us, of course. We are on youtube.com/motorsport101. Check us out over there. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We are on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you want to follow us on Blue Sky as well, you can do so. My personal name, Dre Harrison, is where you can find me. I believe yours is Ryan Eric King King, just like your Twitter.
Same as always.
It rolls right off the tongue. Ryan Eric King, that's with K's. Just trust me on this. And CBuckley917, same as his Twitter, if you want to find us on there. You can also find us on Instagram, instagram.com/motorsport101. Pod, if you want to find us on there, including more of my face, which I'm sorry, is disappointing to say that our podcast is now literally a visual medium. So we've got some highlights on there now, and I've been doing some monologues lately, which you guys seem to be really enjoying. So thank you for the kind words in regards to that. There'll be some more Rover Race Weeks than anything I find mildly interesting to talk about for 3 minutes at a time. So do check that out on Instagram, Motorsport101 Pod. Enjoy. Of course, we've got our website, motorsport101.com, where I'm going through Ask Dre at the moment. If you want to send in your questions, you still can. Let's just say there was an overwhelming theme for the first batch of questions that I got, so much so I kind of had to address it right there and then. You can probably guess what it's about. No, it's not the V10s, I promise. So do check that out, as well as a full review of IndyCar at Thermal and, of course, the Chinese Grand Prix. That'll be our next episode as well on Thermal very, very soon. And, of course, if you're lucky, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to pretty much all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to be listening to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as Ghost Raptor is, as Emma is, as Kira is as well. I think Ed's in here as well. So thank you all very much for listening in. And we've got a new $10 backer. Thank you, Sudi244, for backing us on Patreon. Thank you. Much appreciated for your continued support. And that goes to everybody else as well. I think we've had more Patreon backers now than we've ever had on the pod. So sincere thank you to everybody for your continued support. Much appreciated. Now, before we talk about the big news of the day, we wanted to dedicate a few minutes to the sad news that Eddie Jordan passed away this past Thursday at the age of 76. He was in a year-long battle with prostate cancer, which sadly had spread, and he lost that fight this time last week. Formula One, of course, all over the world of Formula One and beyond, has been laying their tributes to the former F1 team boss and broadcaster as well. And King, it's a sad one, and you know it's sad, but it's also quite in a weird kind of way, sort of happy as well, because Eddie Jordan always brought the humor. He always brought a smile and passion and aplomb to whatever he put his mind to in the world of F1 and beyond. But he was also a pretty remarkable team boss, and I think it's fair to say I'm not sure we're ever going to get this type of team boss in Formula One ever again.
Like, not only team boss, team owner. Like,
oh yeah.
For the most part, F1's current crop of team owners, we never see them. Like, the only one we see on a regular basis is Lawrence Stroll, and I couldn't picture a different person to inherit Eddie Jordan's team than Lawrence Stroll.
It really is the complete opposite, isn't it?
Now that you point that out, yeah, I mean, you know, before like the mid-2000s when Red Bull were the party team coming in, Jordan were the party team, and they brought the party on more than one occasion. I mean, the man lived the dream. He actually got to put together a team that for a short while went and threw punches with the big boys. They legitimately fought for, at least for a time, for a championship in 1999.
That was a whole lot more
than a lot of privateers can ever say. And he did it on a very short notice until, of course, he figured out that he needed to actually, you know, pay those people.
You think a guy that used to work for the Bank of Ireland would eventually figure out that he actually has to occasionally pay off some of that debt. Yeah, he did struggle to keep the lights turned on at times. And look, this is a man who was a hustler. He was from the if you haven't seen it, F1's official YouTube channel did a fantastic video talking about his life and career. Alex Jakes is the perfect voiceover man for just about anything, really, at this point. It was a really, really slick and well-done vid. I do highly recommend it. From the time he was a child, he was selling fruit to the other kids in school for a profit. That's the sort of hustler that Eddie Jordan was. Went karting as a teenager, got hooked, changed his life forever. Next thing you know, he's packing it all in with his wife and leaving Ireland to go to England and risking it all to start a racing team. And that racing team set up many a legendary career. Martin Brundle, okay, maybe not so much as a driver, but certainly as a broadcaster, but also Ayrton Senna and Michael Schumacher both got their starts for Eddie. He had some genuinely great talent come through that team. And as Cam quite rightly said, 1999, third in the Drivers' Championship, third in the Constructors' Championship. Talk about a team that punched above its weight. And I think the spirit of that team lived on, punching up above its weight in the realms of Force India and Racing Point, and well, maybe not so much Aston Martin now, given the account that's behind them. But back in those days, they were a team that made the best of what they could do. And there's people still there in Aston Martin who Jordan originally employed back in 1991 when they really got their start. Mm-hmm. Then they're still there now. And yeah, what a team boss. And for me personally, it's less of a team boss thing, but more of a... He was an exceptional broadcaster as well, because I've been the problem saying this in the past. My favorite era of F1 broadcasting was the BBC days of 2010 to 12, when it was Jake Humphrey, David Coulthard. I'm giving David Coulthard his flowers. this is how much that trio was. Well, hence is how good they were. Eddie Jordan, David Coulthard, and Jake Humphrey. They made BBC F1 genuinely fun to sit down and watch and look forward to every race weekend. They were such a dynamic trio. Eddie was hilariously famous at getting most of his predictions wrong, but that was part of the charm. That was part of why we enjoyed it, so we could laugh with him as well as at him. At the end of the day, he did get the big one of Lewis Hamilton to Mercedes, right? So we got to give him something, right, King?
Yeah. And like, in a certain way, you're right about that. In my mind, F1's always been in two worlds at once, where in one hand, it's a billion-dollar sport backed by sovereign wealth funds, you know, multinational corporations, but it's also always been a sport of misfits and malcontents, and Eddie Jordan was the king of them all.
I think the phrase he came out with in the early 2000s was, Formula One is a circus, you need to find your role within it. Yeah. I think that sums it up very, very well indeed. An incredible team owner in the context of what Formula One is, especially today, because he's, like I said, his type of team owner is never happening again in F1. No, with the amount of money and investment and resources you now need to get into this sport, as we've seen with Cadillac in the last couple of years, Eddie Jordan is never happening again in that sort of sense. So that he's the last of a breed in that sense. And a fantastic broadcaster, even beyond Formula One. He was brilliant on Top Gear as well, on the limited cameos he did have in the days after Clarkson, Hammond and May, when I'm going to miss him. Formula One doesn't have an awful lot of fun left in it, at least in my opinion, and Eddie was that fun. We're going to miss him. My love and condolences to Marie and the family, and I'm off of all of us here at M101. We're going to miss you, Ed, and take care, buddy, and this one's for you, big man. So, after that, and after a little bit of music, let's talk about Liam Lawson. Oh boy. Oh, dear God.
Well, there is breaking news coming out of Formula One. Liam Lawson gone. Red Bull has announced it is demoting Liam after just two Grand Prix with the team and swapping him out with Racing Bulls driver Yuki Tsunoda, who will make his Red Bull debut at home at Suzuka this weekend. What the hell is this?
I thought 2019 and Pierre Gasly getting 12 Grand Prix at Red Bull was bad. And Gasly's results were Gasly's results were nowhere near as terrible as what Lawson's first two weekends were.
Well, Dre, how bad were they?
Well, he did get lapped that one time. But, but besides that, they weren't dreadful.
I'm talking about Liam here.
Well, he finished 12th in this Grand Prix in China, and that was only because we had three disqualifications in the race that propped him up from 15th. Is that good?
Well, I mean, must have had an eventful race. I mean, where did he qualify?
Last.
Oh. Where did he qualify in the sprint?
Last.
Oh, geez. And that's following up from qualifying last in Australia.
18th. He went down, actually. At least he wasn't on the bottom in Australia.
We're talking about a Red Bull driver. Oh, well, at least he wasn't last. Jesus Christ.
I'm still a little bit in shock. I mean, okay, full disclosure, I work for Autosport, right? And Autosport broke the story a few hours after the Grand Prix ended that, yeah, they're going to have an emergency meeting in the next off week now between this week and race week for Japan. And I thought, okay, they'll have a sit down and a talk, but there's no way they're actually going to pull the trigger on this, right? Like, surely they'll give him more than two race weekends before they're actually getting rid of him. Holy fuck. What are we doing here? King, when was the last time someone lost an F1 seat after two races? You know more about the sport than I do.
Off the top of my head, the last time a driver lasted two races or less, it was always planned to be that. Like, they were a substitute.
Right.
Like Andre Lotter coming in a caterer or something like that.
It's never been like this is the contractor driver for the season. George Carlin's get the fuck out of here after two races. we've had people cycle through teams. We've had like situations at Sauber where, I mean, you know, Guido Vandergaard was contracted to drive that one time. He didn't even get a practice session.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Usually you get into double digits or you never race at all. It's never, and you're doing two weekends.
Yeah, Emma in the chat mentions Luca Badoer. Well, that's because of a minor incident that happened at the 2009 Hungarian Grand Prix practice.
Yeah. Where it's like, again, play and substitute.
Yeah, this is genuinely unprecedented. Yuji Ide got four.
Yeah.
Double.
Jesus Christ. When you put it like that. This is just unprecedentedly bad. And look, Lawson wasn't great. I'm not disputing this. Lawson was, on the limited sample size we did see of him in Red Bull, the worst of the four major replacements we've had since. I like to call this the latest chapter of Red Bull from 2018 onwards, when, like, life after Daniel Ricciardo, and I'll talk about a little bit about that in a minute. But for that to happen, for him to get two Grand Prix and then get swapped out, that is just completely unprecedentedly bad. And don't get me wrong, Lawson was awful. There's no getting around it. He qualified dreadfully. He was scrapping with teams that had far worse cars than him on paper. And, you know, Australia, he spun out on a wet track on slick tires and put it in the wall. And he wasn't much better in China. Again, like, no one has ever qualified dead last in a Red Bull two weekends in a row. Ever. not in their 20-year history. That had never happened until now. A part of me gets it in that if you think that this situation is that untenable, then, you know, you rip the Band-Aid off and you give Sonoda as many spins of the roulette wheel as possible. But it still leaves so many unanswered questions, like what was the decision-making process to get us to this point where you had a chance to put Sonoda in December? You waved Sergio Perez goodbye. It was on relatively good terms in the end. This was the chance to put Sonoda in and give him a full offseason. You thought Lawson was the better shot.
To a certain point, I agree. In fact, like this demotion needed to happen. And I also agree where it's like his results at the junior team didn't suggest that things were going to be this bad. Like, it raises questions like, how did this happen? Like, why is he this bad in the Red Bull?
Yeah, I mean, it's on track. I mean, it was visible. There were corners where he was 30 clicks down on Max into turn one of China on his qualifying lap and just fighting the car the whole time. I saw it described on the race where it's like it's almost like he's trying to replicate what Verstappen's doing with the car without actually looking at his data.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so ragged and the car would not work for him. And as far as why Yuki didn't get the seat, bevy of reasons, not least of which Helmut Marko, really need to say it?
Does not like that man.
But also, the Honda partnership ends after this year. He is a Honda contracted guy.
And he has
temperament issues.
Like, to me, that's always been the utmost biggest reason that he's not a Red Bull driver. That not only, you know, contractually not a Red Bull driver, but in the mind of the head of the junior team, Dr. Helmut Marko, I didn't pick this guy. I don't know if he's good.
And it's another conflict between Helmut Marko and Christian Horner. Because if you watch Sky Sports F1, and Horner was very open to talking to the media about this. He did a stand-up interview with Sky Sports F1 after the race was over. He spent several minutes over there. He was being pretty pragmatic about this, saying, look, we're going to look at the data. We're going to try and help him. We're going to give him every chance. And I thought, okay, Horner's standing by his guy. And I'll be honest, some of the questioning from people like Ted Kravitz was vicious. I could get into Kravitz hating Red Bull for another 5 minutes, but I'm going to save you the trouble on this. Kravitz hates that team. It's so obvious he hates that team. It's not even funny anymore. It's more just cringe at this point. But alas, it sounded like Horner wanted to bat for him. And to be fair, Horner generally does bat for his drivers in the face of criticism. He generally has. It's Marco's the one that normally throws them under the bus.
Well, Marko, right after the race, ran to the media and was like, yeah, Yuki's in the form of his life right now. So it's like it's Horner trying to put out fires and gave a legitimate, like a level-headed, well-thought-out argument to Sky and discussion. And then Marko was pouring gasoline from the roof, cackling.
How's it going, Christian? Just setting your driver on fire. Yeah. Literally
and figuratively. So, I mean, I was of the opinion. I mean, they were reasonably close in race trim last year. Yuki 6-0'd the guy in qualifying. Then you put him up against Max Verstappen, who appears to be the only person who can get anything out of this car. And the car is at the point where Max is not happy with it. Max is not happy with the balance that has developed here. And a lot of the discussion has been, well, they build the car around Max. You need to drive, like, the only person who can drive it is Max. Max is not happy right now.
Yeah.
He's pissed.
I think a more apt comparison would be a certain eight-time world champion on two-wheeled machinery driving for another Japanese manufacturer.
Yeah, just because Mark was Neanderthaling his way through the Honda's problems doesn't mean he was happy about it from about 2015 through about 2018.
Right.
And the problem right now is that, like, in the wind tunnel, you don't go in and think, oh, well, this vortex structure will really suit Max. You try to build the fastest car you can, and then the setup, the box of tools was set up as how you can tune that to the drivers.
Hmm.
The problem with Red Bull, and this is carrying over from last year's car, is that, much like Mercedes did when they famously didn't need a wind tunnel to see it, you chase the theoretical performance. You didn't get as much as you thought you would, and it's wrecked the balance of the car. And Max can get on the wheel. He can get up on the wheel and drive it. It's hurting the tires. He's wrecking the tires, trying to fight with other people. So to kind of summarize Red Bull's race, he kind of just ran to a delta and had a pretty lonely time. But to someone uninitiated, that thing must drive like a bucket of bolts.
Well, and you know what the funny thing is? I think it's gotten worse over the years. I mean, the point I was going to make is that Red Bull has longed for a driver like Daniel Ricciardo since he walked away from that team at the end of 2018. And there's many reasons for that. Ricciardo didn't want to be a number two in Red Bull setup. He could clearly read the tea leaves and see where the focus was going. It was going towards Max. He had a horrible 2018 backstretch where he was riddled with DNFs and you know, shit that wasn't his fault. He was clearly frustrated towards the end of his time at Red Bull. And of course, Renault made him a big fuck-off offer of something like $36 million in cash. He was Renault's highest paid employee when he was over with that team. He was making more money than Carlos Ghosn was, and he did crime and everything. Yeah,
he was making more money than Carlos Ghosn. He was, again, Renault, a state-owned company. He was making more money than Emmanuel Macron, the president of France.
The highest paid French government employee
And since that time, they've gone through Pierre Gasly, that lasted 12 Grand Prix. He was there with the team. Alex Albon was then drafted in after only himself doing 12 Grand Prix and losing out the head-to-head to Daniil Kvyat at the time. Another Red Bull guy they famously demoted and swapped out for Verstappen for no good reason besides, we're going to lose Max Verstappen. Someone's got to fall on this grenade.
Good enough reason in hindsight.
It had to be done, but it doesn't make it any less shitty in that sense. But on top of that, you know, Albon was there for a year and a half, wasn't deemed good enough. They wanted experience. They brought in Sergio Perez, who was hotter than fish grease at the end of 2020. They brought him in. He started out all right, but his
21 was fine. Most of 22 was fine. And then you get to the inflection point in 23, and that is Spain 2023, when Red Bull made their first big development misstep. And we didn't know it at the time because Max could drive through the problem, and they lost one race that year. At that point, you trust the numbers.
Exactly.
But in carrying on with that path, it worked. It worked at the start of the season with the RB20. They beat the field into a pulp five or six races to start the year. And then they botch a floor upgrade in Imola at the same one race after McLaren completely redesigns their car and go on to the path that they're on now, where McLaren is kicking ass and taking names, even despite their best efforts, which we'll get into a little bit later. Red Bull's kind of in their almost in. Remember, like, middle of 2020.
Yeah.
Figured out the problem from the start of the year, but it took more time to fix it.
Yeah,
that's kind of where they are right now, where the car isn't really drivable in the way that Max wants to drive it, but he can get around it. And he's sitting second in the drivers' championship as a result. Albon got blown into the weeds by midseason, and we just saw exactly the same thing happen to Lawson to an even bigger extent, because when you chase the theoretical performance and wreck the car balance, you better hope the car is good enough to compensate, and the car just isn't right now. It's not slow, but it is very, very difficult to extract pace from.
Yeah, it's and I think by hitching themselves to that boat deeper and deeper, it's just going to make it. And Rebels acknowledge this themselves off the record. You have to support Max because he's your only shot at a championship. We all know how good he is.
But Max has been vocal about it. Max has been saying the car balance has been getting worse and worse since the middle of 23. And they trusted the numbers over their lead guy. The only reason why they're winning shit right now, or even competitive.
But because they were still winning.
But it's not an overnight thing.
No.
They only just started to correlate and fix this in Baku last year. And the fix that they put out then enabled him to seal up the driver's title in Brazil and Qatar. But it's a path, and it's not a quick one. They also need to fix this before 2026, because if you build an entire car in 26 built on wrong data, you're going to look like Mercedes in 2022.
Hey, how's that floor going?
My spine hurts.
And, you know, to sort of steer stuff back to how we got here, like the move to bring Yuki in is almost an admission that this is a long-term issue. Like, right now, their junior team is pretty much depleted. Like, if they're bringing Yuki in, he's going to be there for a while.
He has to be. You've got no choice now. You're pretty much locked into Tsunoda until at least the end of this season, and probably more, because who's left? Isaac Hadji, who has one Grand Prix of experience to his name and one quarter of a formation lap, but plenty of hugs from Anthony Hamilton, and that's important. And the second part of that is that beyond that, it's Arvid Lindblad and vibes. Like, Lindblad is in Formula 2, and we all know that Formula 2 is a glorified lottery at this point. Teams are not taking Formula 2 seriously anymore. Like, I've heard the talk that Red Bull are going to roll out the two-year-old car testing program for Lindblad, and they're going to give him every shot in the sim. He's apparently going to get multiple FP1s later on in the year. Where the hell was this for Lawson if the plan was you were going to promote him at the end of last year? Because they didn't want to spend the money.
Yeah, Red Bull's been very vocal. They don't feel like spending the money on that. Mercedes gave all that time to Antonelli, and it's worked out pretty darn well so far. I mean, Kimi's been fine. It's been better than fine, even.
He's been great.
And Lawson didn't get any of that. But now, here's the problem. You made the decision you should have made, really, on form at the end of last year. So now Yuki's had no preseason. He's going to have no time in this car other than a test session after Abu Dhabi last year in the previous Red Bull.
Like, honestly,
lost all this prep time.
Yeah, because honestly, this kind of backtracks to just simple, straight up junior team mismanagement for years, because they thought, we have Verstappen now. We don't really have to take driver development seriously anymore. And it came back to bite them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is all they've got left. And no pressure, Yuki. Is your first Grand Prix is only your home race in front of Honda, in front of your home fan base, and the biggest opportunity of your racing life so far on one of the most difficult technical circuits we go to. Good luck, buddy. Quite frankly, if he gets points, it'll be considered a miracle.
I'd say, if he gets points, he'd rip your arm off for points at this point. Red Bull would rip your arm off for points for the second car. Like, yeah. That would be a gigantic improvement. But that just shows how bad the situation is right now. And I mean, for Lawson, he's chopped liver in that program. I don't know. He's not going back to Red Bull, and he better show up for V-Car, because no one else is touching him after that.
Well, the body of evidence suggests he was pretty good in a V-Car in his 11 previous Grand Prix that he had with them. He was good there. He scored points on a semi-regular basis, and he wasn't far off Yuki Tsunoda in race trim anyway. He should be fine. Racing Wheels clearly has a more balanced setup.
He should be fine. Hopefully.
But it did break him over his knee.
Broke him over his knee, and also, like, he now has had no prep time in that car. So all the prep time he's just used for the last 4 months is worthless.
Yep.
It's the wrong timing. It's the right decision 4 months late.
So you're admitting you've made a mistake by potentially making another one. And that's the only choice they've got left now.
Because... Yep. I think circling back to this decision, in some ways it felt like their hand was forced. They knew that their junior team was relatively depleted. Lawson was shopping around with other teams. It seemed like he had a serious offer on the table. And they were given the ultimatum. Sign Lawson to the senior team or potentially lose one of your few, you know, high profile young drivers to a rival. And they kept him in house.
Mm-hmm.
What an unserious team. Like, if this was any other Formula One team, Horner would have been yanked out of the door by now for gross incompetence. Because this is just... It's so embarrassing that Red Bull had to go through... You've dropped a dude after two Grand Prix. Two.
Yep.
It's unspeakably bad that it's gone to this extreme already. Jesus Christ. Right, let's talk about the Grand Prix. And, well, it was Oscar Piastri who qualified on pole ahead of George Russell. Great lap from him to get on the front row in second, and Lando Norris starting from third. We should have known where this was going when Lando Norris somehow got a great start and actually beat Russell for second on the open. I was like, yeah, McLaren's off to the races.
Lando Norris gained position on an opening lap. Pinch me, I must be dreaming.
It's over. Well, we knew straight away that this was done, especially when Max dropped back to sixth and struggled early on. Piastri led this race pretty much from lights to flag, never really looked like he was going to lose. And despite a late scare with some brake issues we'll talk about in a minute, Lando Norris was able to limp home in second to secure McLaren's 50th 1-2 finish in their team's history. George Russell, back-to-back third places in Grand Prix and very quietly going about his business well. Mercedes' 300th career podium in their time in F1. Lewis Hamilton has 153 of those, is a fun fact there for you. Verstappen came on strong at the end to finish in fourth, and he probably had the move of the race as well, going around the outside of Charles Leclerc, down the corkscrew. Very, very fun indeed. Great pace from him at the end of the race. However, for the first time since Canada 2004, we had three cars disqualified after the flag. Amazingly, Pierre Gasly and Charles Leclerc were both disqualified for their cars both being underweight, under the new 800 kilo weight limit, because they did up it by a couple to compensate for driver weight. So it's now 800 kgs rather than 798. And Lewis Hamilton, in a horrible war flashback to Austin 2023, was disqualified because his rear skid block had too much wear, and that bumped everybody below them up three spots, including Esteban Ocon, for example, now in fifth for Haas. Their best result.
Haas just had their second best weekend as a team
ever,
after having one of their worst ever weekends as a team.
Yeah, Oli Bearman was eighth after the DQs. Lance Stroll got a couple of points in ninth. Carlos Sainz got his first point as a Williams driver in tenth. Alex Albon, another sixth place finish. Williams had double-digit points on the weekend. Williams have more points than Ferrari do right now.
Now they're tied on countback, because this becomes important in a moment. Sprints don't count for countback.
Nope.
I would refer you to a different statistic. A Haas driver is now the top Ferrari in the Drivers' Championship. But that has never happened before.
Esteban Ocon has 1 point more than Lewis Hamilton does in the championship after two race weekends.
Exactly as the form book predicted coming out of preseason testing.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, King, how ominous a beating was out of the front by McLaren? Because if they're all like that, then this could be a long season.
Like, one part of me says this can't last forever. There's no way McLaren can maintain this rate of development and actual execution through December. But on the other hand, we just spent how long talking about Red Bull? We're also talking about a Ferrari double disqualification. They are literally handing trophies to McLaren.
I said, George Russell's just following them home. Mercedes somehow have built a car that is a jack of all trades, master of none. And he's just coming home on the podium every weekend.
Yeah,
but he can't go up and fight with them.
Has George Russell been on TV in these last two weekends combined for more than 4 minutes?
It's been a very it's been a very lonely drive with, like, his favorite podcast playing.
I'm just going to rack up these thirds. Like, it's Sebastian Vettel in 2015. I'm just going to finish third every week. It's going to be great. Might occasionally steal one on the back on the way out, but this is fine.
Oh, you can just look at the Ferraris and go, were you low again?
Just, if Russell starts poking fun at Norris in press conferences, we know it's over. essentially, but yeah, that was dominant from McLaren. They look like, I think, as you said, Cam, they just seem to have a bigger performance window in more conditions than everybody else does right now. They just seem to have just a better baseline that they can just apply to more places, because medium tire, hard tire, you know, rain, sun, doesn't matter. So far, McLaren's been pretty much untouchable so far.
Yeah, I mean, we've got four cars that are in pretty similar speed at the front. The problem is that only one of them is in the window all the time, and it is the McLaren. They're very good on their tires. They're decent enough in a straight line. It does everything well. Ironically, again, going back to like the Red Bull aspect of things, they have chased the theoretical performance a little bit. Mm. And if you ask both drivers, it has hurt the balance of the McLaren a little bit. But it's predictable, and they have the performance. If you get that performance, it kind of doesn't matter what it does to the car, as long as you can drive around it. And right now, the two of them can. I mean, Piastri did the job that probably should have been able to have been done in Australia, because he never looked like he was really going to lose this race.
Yeah, and it's funny, because that became the big Thursday media day talking point, was Lando Norris basically admitting, yeah, I don't give McLaren feedback to suit me anymore. I just tell them, make the fastest car available and I'll adapt to it. And that was, and like everybody else in the paddock were like, the fuck out of here. what is this nonsense you're talking about? Because everyone's like, but you guys are like two steps quicker than everybody else. And that was the general consensus coming out of testing. And that's pretty much held firm over the course of the season so far, that McLaren, yeah, probably did have a couple of attempts on the field. And that's how it's played out so far on track. But, I mean, okay, big weekend for Piastri to come back after. I mean, all this talk about, hey, Piastri ceiling's higher, we've been waiting for this day, Piastri was dominant, he's a world title contender. Have we forgotten he was reversing out of a wet grass patch 8 days before that happened?
Hey, everyone went off that corner. He went deep enough to get stuck.
He committed to it. He was committed. Yeah, that's how a racing driver should be, right, King? Yeah, but but he did take, I think it was 13 out of the 23 points back that he lost to Norris in Australia, which is big for Piastri. Fun fact of the bookies, you can get Piastri 2-1 to win the world title right now, which they'd have called you crazy for that halfway through last year. But now a lot of people, I think, are starting to throw their chips in the Australians' direction, thinking that, hey, that potential will get us there. Very early days, yeah, is what I would say. And I think, Cam, like, I think the qualifying for me is going to be a lot of where this, I think, is going to be won or lost, because Piastri qualifying on pole, in my opinion, opened the door to a lot of this win.
Well, the theme on track this weekend was dirty air, filthy air, awful air. To follow someone. The dirty air that this track has always been known for, coupled to these cars, which are in the last year of their development and have slowly morphed back into the dirty air machines, and then you put a resurface on the track on top of that, if you had to follow someone, the tires just melted like ice cream in the sun.
Yeah, we saw it in the sprint, in particular. Max trying everything he could early on to try and get around Lewis Hamilton, who had stolen pole off the McLaren's botched sprint qualifying, cooked his tyres doing so. Again, very Australian-esque in how that turned out. And that's how Piastri got him late on. And if that sprint was a couple of laps longer, Russell and Leclerc probably get him too.
Dre, after the sprint, I mean, Lewis ran in clean air the whole time. His tyres were visibly awful looking. Mm-hmm. Out at the front, if you had to follow anyone in the sprint, it was a few degrees hotter, and you were on the soft tire, which was just a dud this weekend. There was no following someone, because you would goose your tires in three laps. Max got up into Lewis's dirty air for about three laps, and he lost his front tires and never got them back. By the time Oscar got around him, his tires were cooked, and Lewis pulled away at the front. And that should have set us up for a lot of tire wear and interesting strategy on race day. It did not. It's the hard tire was the other direction where it would just run half the race, no problem, and we got a one stopper.
Pirelli, please.
It's like their tires are the worst of all worlds at the moment.
Yeah, it's like the meat.
In addition to this resurface. This resurface was cheeks.
Yeah, like, I think we need to mention that Shanghai International Circuit resurfaced the entire track without telling anybody.
Yeah, cornering speeds were higher, braking distances were shorter, and load through the tires went through the roof.
It's kind of wild that in qualifying, we were going into the 130s around Shanghai. There were 3 seconds a lap faster over a single lap in qualifying trim, but were 9 seconds off the pace in race trim because of how badly they were trying to save their medium tires on heavy fuel early on. That's the contrast in between what the extra grip will get you over a single lap, then having to deal with that extra grip and abrasion, especially on the front left, when we actually got to race time. The medium tire at the start under heavy fuel was unusable, but the hard tire, it was perfect. So you just run that sucker into the ground. The free course of the race was possible on those tires, and it was a little bit cold as well, which definitely helped as well. It was 10 degrees cold. We got a little bit of rain actually just after the race was over, because that's how Formula One works. It rains immediately after a Grand Prix finishes these days. But the hard tire was the race tire of choice, which is funny because no one had ran them at all. Because only had one
everyone was
session.
Coveting them like gold up to that point in the weekend.
Exactly, because it's a sprint weekend. You only get 12 sets for the whole weekend. You know, it's 2, 4, and 6. You get 6 softs, you get 4 mediums and 2 hards, and that's it. That's eradication for the whole weekend. So you're not going to use the hards up anywhere, and mediums and softs are mandatory in sprint qualifying. So they were always going to covet the hard tire, and surprise, surprise, Pirelli once again makes a hard compound tire that can do 3/4 of the race, and it completely kills any idea of a strategic race whatsoever. It's just like, oh, great, it's another one stopper, guys. Great, lovely, thanks, bye.
Yeah, it is. And even is beyond that, like, if a McLaren qualifies at the front, it's probably over for at least these first couple races before people start getting upgrades on the cars.
Is this going to boil down to June 2nd? And the front wing test change for the FIA, the Spanish Grand Prix, is that the key date to circle here?
I think you're going to see updates from teams before then, but in terms of whether McLaren are going to romp this home, probably, because I mean, do we want to talk about Lando Norris's sprint?
Awful start.
He ain't beating the allegations.
Awful start, got stuck behind Lance Stroll, and then spent 3/4 of the sprint not able to keep up with him, and then finally got him late on.
Why did he get struck behind? First of all, Lance Stroll beating the allegations thus far this year.
Lance Stroll, genuinely good so far this season. Like, genuinely, he's been really solid so far this year.
But Lando decided that he wanted to go sightseeing at, Turn 4?
No.
Just sent himself off over the curb and got passed by 3 dudes. So somehow, despite McLaren just laying the hammer 2 weekends in a row, Max is 8 points behind in the driver's title right now.
And Max Verstappen is out here begging for performance. He thinks he's in the sport's 4th best car right now, and he's still only 8 points off the top, purely because he's been able to scrape home every point he can muster. That's what Max does. This is what he does. He's just that good.
He's not going to let them get away with it. Not easily. And in fairness to the Red Bull, second half of that race, Max was the fastest car on track.
Yeah, he was money.
I think they ran too conservative a delta on the mediums. They probably could have used a little more of the tire, pitted when they did, and then maybe they hassle Russell for third, maybe. But at the end of the day, he's getting everything that car has to give and more.
That thing is a donkey, and Max is still making it competitive enough where I still think he'll probably win a couple of Grand Prix this year if everything falls his way. He needs a lot of help right now, but I wouldn't completely rule that out.
The stiffer the wings get, the better off Red Bull's going to be. Can I have the floor for just like 30 seconds?
The floor is yours, Cameron Buckley.
What did Yuki Tsunoda do in a past life?
I've got nothing.
What sin was committed for him to be subject to this torture? And that's not even getting into the Red Bull yet.
I mean, it is kind of wild that Tsunoda probably should have a pair of top sixes to start this season. He was running top five in Australia. He qualified fifth, but stayed out when the rain came down. That was a mistake. Cost him points. Sixth in the sprint here in China. Excellent. He held off Kimi Antonelli behind him. Finished sixth in the sprint. Was put on a two-stopper in the Grand Prix, which, as everybody worked out by half distance, was not the move. Was put on a two-stopper, and then Tsunoda's front wing collapses. In plain sight. Drops to 19th. Tsunoda has been genuinely outstanding so far this season. He has next to nothing to show for it besides that sixth place in the sprint.
I hate it out here. He's been my driver of the year thus far, honest to God. And with nothing to show for it.
No, he has 3 whole points from that Chinese sprint. 3
points. Racing Bull should be a genuine P4 in the constructors right now, and they are not. And that infuriates me.
They have a genuinely good car. Like, it's a good all-round machine. And like, Isaac Hadjit in his first, like, second ever Grand Prix
been
weekend.
Good so far.
He's been qualified 7th for the Grand Prix. Like, this kid is good. Like, okay, when he's not spinning out in a formation lap, the rest of the time he's been pretty solid so far. Getting his elbows out, he's scrapped well, he's raced well, he's certainly got 1 lap speed by the looks of it. This kid's
qualified,
all right.
Yeah, qualified Tsunoda. Plug him in the Red Bull.
I love that the idea of a Tsunoda being rewarded for the form of his life is a trip to the RB21. It's the F1 equivalent of being sent to Galveston, Texas.
Go down that Red Bull with all that dirty water. It appears Charles Barkley has won that war with all the people selling their Airbnbs out there.
Oh, jeez.
But yeah, because like early on is when you may, like, Williams right now are cashing in everything. They have their total points haul from last year
already.
Racing Bull should be right there, and instead they've got 3 on the board right now.
It's wild. It's wild. Kane, we got to talk about Ferrari.
How do you solve a problem like Ferrari?
Scientists have been asking this for 17 years, and for 17 years, the answer consistently is, well, at least when kids draw a race car, it'll be red.
King, Hamilton, we talked about earlier, Hamilton dominated the sprint in the end. By the time that it was over, he was several seconds down there. And the moment he heard that Piastri was in second, he was like, nope, we're checking out of here. We're not even entertaining the idea of the Australian catching up. Won the sprint to his bemusement, which I thought was also quite funny. Trying to play, so like, no, guys, we're not there yet.
We don't know why.
Like,
little did we know.
So there's the small matter of ride height, where you can get away with a more aggressive ride height in the sprint because, well, it's the sprint; it's much shorter distance.
Yeah, it's not like they have it in the rules saying, "Hey, you're not allowed to wear the plank as much in the sprint to compensate for the shortened distance." You can wear out even more.
Just grind that sucker out.
Yeah. So, Ferrari raised his car half a millimeter after the sprint, a little bit more conservative, and there goes all the pace.
Yep. Place completely spent. Hamilton was in no man's land. They had to swap with his teammate. Like, it was Hamilton. Okay, For full Fred, if you're listening, I'm going to give you the full context, because I know you didn't like how the radio messages played out. I'm going to give him the full context. Hamilton asked to swap because he knew Charles was going quicker. Charles Leclerc beats Hamilton straight up with a broken front wing.
No. We know Charles Leclerc gains 50 points of speed anytime he breaks his front wing. He's been doing it for years.
That's a hell of a special ability. That's something off a fucking Yu-Gi-Oh card. Like, what are we doing here?
I'm convinced if you took the front wing off of Charles Leclerc's car, he would win the driver's championship four races early. I'm convinced. But, so if the SF25 is the F2004 a millimeter off the ground, and the F93A when it's 1.5 millimeters off the ground, well, surely that was enough safety margin.
Apparently not.
Lewis
was curb riding a bit too much. He got DQ'd for excessive rear plank damage. Yes, it's exactly why he got DQ'd at Mercedes 2 years ago in Austin. And Leclerc was underweight. I mean, King, that just says to me, I mean, it's not as straightforward as, oh, the switch to the one-stopper, like how George Russell got caught out. It's probably a combination of factors. The fueling, we didn't get a safety car in this race. It was green lights to flag. You know, there was probably the time I probably factored in a little bit as well. But, I mean, what a haulix for Ferrari. This has never happened in their history, ever, as a team where they've had both cars DQ'd.
Yeah, there's no other way to put it. It was a series of preventable yet unfortunate events.
Dre, I don't know if you've seen, Leclerc also drives like off track 3 times on his formation lap. I think they had an inkling that they were real close. Because with all that pickup, he was still, what, was about half a kilo down.
Yeah, to clarify this, people don't know this, in Parc Fermé, if you come into Parc Fermé with a broken car or have a obviously broken part, you are allowed to replace it with a like-for-like copy before you go on the weighbridge. This is what happened. They replaced Leclerc's front wing. Apparently, that was worth about 200 grams. That goes to show you how light these front wings actually are. The piece was only 200 grams total, which is, God, about 4 ounces. Crazy. Anyway, they replaced the front wing, they put it on the weighbridge, it's fine, and like, apparently he was exactly 800 kilos when they replaced the front wing, and this is before they took the fuel sample out, and that's what put them a kilo under. When you look at it like that, it wasn't close. They were a kilo out, which
it's not great.
Not great, Bob.
Again, back to the running theme of these four cars are quite close, but the window is what makes them. The Ferrari looks extremely ride height dependent. It is either grease lightning or kind of in no man's land, because the Ferrari's just kind of had a lonely race until Max Verstappen came knocking with Leclerc later on.
So Leclerc's a kilo under. I think Gasly was half a kilo under in the Alpine when he was DQ'd. Again, just too close to margin on that. And then Hamilton, rear plank, too much wear. So again, he's just been riding the curbs too much, I assume, for that to happen.
Well, the thing is that like F1 has had scenarios where they have allowed that based on, like, if you can prove this is damage, they'll give you the free pass.
Mm.
So I'm not so sure, because I remember Lotus back in the day had a scenario with Kimi where he fell foul of it, and then they were able to prove it was damage. Not great. Not great. Because we don't know if Leclerc was running too low, because he probably got disqualified from the weight bridge first.
Exactly. I mean, and to be fair to Ferrari, they released their statement. They held their hands up and said, nope, there's no mitigating circumstances. We just got this wrong, and we're going to learn from this. Oh, I love that, as Kira points out as well, Hamilton and Leclerc being disqualified together, it really is like Austin all over again. We'll always have that combined photo on Instagram mood. They both sat there knowing they'd both been disqualified.
This is where I come to cry. Cool.
Oh, dear. And the most punishing part of that, 43 conceded points to McLaren. The worst possible scenario.
Dre, put it in rice. This Constructors' Championship is done rounds early. It's like Red Bull are nowhere close. Mercedes are there or thereabouts, but it's usually Russell and then a couple more cars to Kimi while Kimi gets up to speed.
Kimi's not quite there.
He's not quite there, and Ferrari just had an awful weekend, and then gestures wildly all of this shit, because it's somehow both better in that they won the sprint and worse than Australia. You found a way to win a race, keep that, and then just get just double disqualified in the same weekend. Only in the sprint format.
I've told you that they found new ways to haunt. I find it miraculous that in year 75 of their F1 history, they are discovering new ways to shit the bed. It's amazing.
They never make the same mistake twice.
Apart from when they did, because they got DQ'd at Austin 23 for the same reason.
I think if we're running back the classics, I think next race they should try to undercut Fresh Air.
Sounds like a plan. We'll keep tabs on that for Japan next week. Before we get out of here as well, this is another one of those.
Wasn't that in Japan as well? Like 2016?
It was, ironically.
Dear God, I didn't even realize that when I said it.
I forgot. That was an accident. Yeah, well played, Cam. Well played. Before we get out of here, this was a story that gained even more smoke due to my colleagues as well. Also, they published this as well. They had a sit down with Nicholas Tombassis, who is the FIA's head of single-seater development. There is genuine smoke behind a move to switch Formula One to V10s. Again, hi Glenn Freeman.
I wish y'all could see King's. If you're listening to the audio form of this podcast, I wish you could see King's reaction.
King is bemused. He's beside himself.
In our set list, I wrote, no, seriously, who is this for?
Yes, exactly. The text I put in the question asks is this viable? I mean, for context, Mohamed Ben Salim, the president of the FIA, wants to put together a working group to investigate the idea of V10s, maybe for 2028, potentially 2029 seems, quote, more feasible, in inverted commas, and potentially running them on sustainable fuels to bring back the noise and excitement of the V10 era. And what I will say is that never have I ever seen an FIA president try to get the home run of PR support in what is an election year for the man, let's not forget.
I think we need to clarify, PR in an election year, he's trying to gain support from people who don't have votes.
You pissed off most
of public opinion, King.
Their votes matter, right? If you're over the age of 50. You know, it's such, we're burying the lead here. We all think this is just complete bullshit.
Honestly, he could run his entire campaign on MBS. I'll bring back the V10s.
Like, yes, he's trying to win public opinion from literal, like, F1 online boomers. Not the people who actually pay for F1 to happen. The car companies, who very much do not want this to happen.
Well, here's my brain. Actually, and the problem is that it's working, because I had a very long-winded argument in another Discord server, and I told this person, you are literally falling for it. That fell for it again award.
Oh, it's
so, here's the thing, right? If you disable everything about that is so boomerish about this.
There's a lot.
And there is a lot. There is a mountain of boomerism here. You just developed brand new engines for 2026.
Mm-hmm.
You just brought in a manufacturer and a half.
Nice sticker.
Nice sticker. They're working on the ERS system. Don't you worry. Mm-hmm. Jim Farley, please don't call us.
We love you, Jim.
unless you're offering me a new Mustang for free. Here's the deal.
Don't look under the seat, bro.
I just can't with you, King. It's always so fun when you're on. We killed Dre.
That was so uncalled for. That was a torpedo to HMS Buckley in New Hampshire. What the hell was that?
Good Lord.
That's an old timer.
Let's just roll down the list.
Please do. Get me out of this, please.
Audi has already publicly said fuck no.
No.
And if we, the other rumors that they could delay or scrap the 2026 engines, well, let's leave Sauber, Red Bull, and Racing Bulls, and Alpine with no engines.
Right.
Honda absolutely would say no to this.
No chance.
Mercedes, no. They threatened to leave Formula One when they weren't doing as much technologically back in 2013, and are very vocal about showing off the F1 derived technology in their road cars and their hybrids and their turbos.
Mm.
The only people who I think would be okay with this would be Ferrari, because their brand is Formula One and they'll just
They'll do what they need to do because it's Ferrari. They're never going to quit.
And the thing is, Ferrari, again, have pivoted to go all in on marketing their Formula One technology in their road cars, like they always have.
Always have.
The only ones that I feel like would have no vice with this would be Red Bull powertrains because, well, they're a racing car engine company.
Yeah, they'll do whatever takes a win. And like
they are not beholden to anything but the regulations they're building the engines to.
And the even bigger, well, it's not bigger than this, but another issue is that, like, if you do this, you're also, like, discouraging manufacturers from joining. Renault ain't coming back for this in terms of building their own.
Cosworth ain't coming back.
They ain't coming back.
This feels like, Cosworth, come back. No, Cosworth is never coming back, and they stunk the last time they were here. And they stunk for a long time before they end up leaving. It's very clearly pandering to the bring back V10s crowd to go, hey, remember the good old days when there was like four cars on the lead lap? Remember when the only teams that could win were the three manufacturers with engines worth a damn? You want that back, right? Because it goes down the strings.
Cam's covered most of the reasoning. Like I said, it would be a spit in the face to the sustainability message that Formula One has tried to push towards for the last 20 plus years. But
most sustainable fuels, Dre.
Like that notion, that notion of it's cool, it'll have sustainable fuels.
Bullshit.
Literally screams that you have no idea what sustainable or environmentalism even is.
Sustainable fuels right now are not sustainable. They need to spend a ludicrous amount of energy that you are not getting back to create them in the first place. It sounds sexy, but at the scale it's being produced at right now, it is not sustainable. This is not going to help you get towards your net zero carbon aims you're talking about for 2030 at all. It's bullshit. Environmentalist is saying it's bullshit.
and it goes beyond that when you look at like the technical side, because like would high revving NAV10s hooked up to hybrid systems be any cheaper than twin turbo V6s? Not really. We've ditched the MGUH. It's going to be a much more traditionally constructed engine compared to what we've had for the last decade and some change.
Yeah, because
you can't ditch the hybrids.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a rear brake disc technology that can stop these things without MGUK support.
because the current engine formula on the horizon, which is going to use sustainable fuels, is the best way to implement it. It is a way where Formula One teams can use their technical might to find a way to make it viable to mass produce, find a way to get the most efficiency possible out of it, to make it a worthwhile venture, not just dumping it into a V10 engine for the sound.
Yeah, like, we went to hybrids in the first place because the V8s we had before it, and of course the predecessor V10s, were incredibly inefficient in terms of fuel. Like, we're going to go back to the dark ages by having V10s back in the cars again. It's nonsense.
But it sounds good. And like, and remember the talk in 2012 to 13 when, like, the LMP1 category, back when before the spending went supernova in 2014... There were complaints the world over that, well, is it the pinnacle of motorsport if it's not the pinnacle of technology? But now you want to go back to V10s. And it would not make the racing better inherently.
No.
If anything, I actually think it would make it worse, because if you lose all those engine manufacturers, first of all, ask CART how that went in 2002 when you said, well, this is what we're doing with the engines. Leave if you don't like it. Where are you guys going?
The biggest hook on Formula One's current value, in my opinion, is the fact that they're going to have 6 power unit manufacturers by 2028. Yep. Under this current regulation set. That's a huge shot in the arm for almost everybody else in global motorsport. You have the giants of the automotive industry all unified in agreement that this is the way we should be developing road-relevant technology. The literal pinnacle of motorsport technology right now is on the grid as we speak, and it's never been this healthy before. Look, I can't remember the time where we had 6 engine manufacturers in Formula One, and they all agreed on the same regulation set, and they want to be here. You know how wild that is?
Yeah. And Bill, so you could get the private, like, you could get the little guys building the engines again. Well, the little guys weren't competitive back in the day either.
No. Like again,
Cosworth was not competitive. Mugen Honda, until Honda took over the operation, not competitive. Hart Racing Engines is gone. It's just pandering to nostalgia, and MBS knows exactly what he's doing, because he's never seen a fight that he wouldn't pick, and it's destroyed any PR he might have, so he's picking the lowest hanging fruit that he could pick up. Hey, if you vote for me, I'll bring your V10s back.
It's not for the votes. It's a tear Formula One apart from the inside.
Right. You know what it is? It's him poking a sticker at all the stakeholders in F1 and going, this is what I want to do. And right now the FOM is, go on then, bet. Go on. Try it. See what happens. Like, Mohammed bin Salim might not be FIA president by the time we have any kind of agreement on this at all, which is extremely unlikely as is.
No, the thing is, if he wins re-election, there's, like, he'd be near the end of his term by the time this gets put in the force.
Right.
Well, again, the thing is, like, the sunk cost fallacy. You just put all this development time into all these engines. If you tell all these engine manufacturers, well, throw those in the trash, we're going to V10s 3 years later.
Yeah, they're all going to quit.
Like, they're all going to quit. That's going to be hundreds of billions of dollars in marketing value leaving the sport.
Yeah,
that's the point. MBS wants that to happen.
He's not a serious person.
Like, Sauber as a team will die. Yeah, if Audi backs out on this.
Yeah, like who's picking up Sauber? Like, who's buying a Formula One team in this market?
Some out there, if you're trying to, because again, it's not the money pit that it was because of how they structured the sport, but it still isn't good. It's not a smart decision.
Nothing about this is smart or viable. It just feels like it's political tools and javelins being thrown in other camps' directions. It's completely ludicrous, and the only net gain is appealing to the sort of Formula One fan who's over the age of 40 and thinks that the V10s were the golden age when they had just as many problems back then as we do in the sport now. And it's nonsense, it's bullshit, and it's yet more political point scoring from an FIA president that's made his entire tenure as FIA president about point scoring. And it's laughably stupid. Let's never talk about this again. I can't stand it.
Basically, so clearly, 3 years from now, we're going to be talking about the new F1 V10 engines, and I'm personally going to have a 5-minute crash out on the server.
I will jump out of my bedroom window the day that happens. That is not going to be a thing. Okay, that'll do it for this episode of Motorsport 101. We'll be back, Formula One-wise, at least after the Japanese Grand Prix next weekend. We'll see how Yuki Tsunoda's debut in Red Bull fares. I'm praying for that boy.
Please.
I'm praying for that man.
Of joy.
We'll be back for another episode shortly on the Thermal Club Racer IndyCar. Well, most of it. And of course, MotoGP will be back next week as well. Our bikes in Marquez land, the Circuit of the Americas, going for Grand Prix win number 8 for Marc Marquez at the Circuit of the Americas. It's kind of gratifying to even just think about that. It's crazy. Until next time, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been Ryan Eric King and Cameron Buckley. Until next time, thank you very much for listening. Take care. Sayonara. That's just it. That's just Cam's fine. That's the outro. Perfect.